Please enjoy this Legends of Sport classic with Coach Valerie Condos Field.
Hello and welcome back to Legends of Sport podcast. I'm Andy Bernstein, your host. I am thrilled to be back with you as I am every week. This week is a little bit of a stretch for me, at least it was when we were first talking to this guest. Her name is Valerie Condos Field, and she was not on my radar screen, I got to be honest with you, but my producer, Dominique, kind of twisted my arm and convinced me that she would be a great guest. And I got to tell you, I mean, I'm not just blowing smoke here, that she was literally one of the best guests that we've had on the podcast. I think maybe if I don't know about the person, I'm better off, because I find out so much through Dominique's great research and Jonah's great research, our writer and researcher, and then developing the questions, and then, of course, talking to her, which we're going to get to in a second. Just a little bit of background on Valerie. Valerie actually started out as a ballerina and a concert pianist, and she was choreographing the floor exercises, which are essentially dance routines for gymnasts. And as she talks about, and you'll hear it, out of the blue, UCLA hires her to become their head gymnastics coach. This was like 27 years ago. And she thought that maybe they got the wrong number, because she didn't really know how to coach gymnastics. But she grew into the job. She hired the right people. And she's become an icon of women's gymnastics, multiple championships. So many of her athletes have gone on to the Olympics and to glory. And she has an incredible story, not just how she started, but she's a breast cancer survivor. And the story that she has about how that made her a stronger person, and her mantra of be anxious for nothing but grateful for all things. An incredible affirmation, what can I tell you? So let's get into our interview with Valerie, and we'll see you on the backside. Thanks. All righty. Well, welcome to another episode of Legends of Sport. Today, we have UCLA gymnastics coach Valerie Condos Field, or Miss Val, which I've been told I need to refer to you as Miss Val, with us on our show. It's an honor to have you in the studio and to be part of our podcast. You've accomplished so much, not just as a coach, but in actual real life. And your story, to me, is incredibly compelling. I'd like to start from the beginning, as we usually do, is how people got off the ground, how they became who they are. But you kind of took a roundabout route to become a gymnastics coach. Born in Sacramento, right?
Yes.
Classical pianist.
Yes.
Dancer.
Yes.
So how the heck do you become a gymnastics coach?
Serendipity, the yeah. universe. I was 16 years old, and it was 1976, and I wanted a summer job. I was a ballet dancer. Mm-hmm. Obviously in high school, and I loved gymnastics, and mm-hmm. my parents would not let me stop dancing, and I was also a classical pianist, so mm-hmm. they're like, your plate is full enough, no, we're not adding gymnastics. And so I called up a local gym, and I asked them if they needed a dance coach, mm-hmm. and they said they didn't have money for that, and somehow in the conversation they found out that I played the piano. And a little trivia here, mm-hmm. before 1980, floor exercise music for gymnasts could only be one instrument.
Huh. And was it live?
They had compulsories as yeah. well as optional routines. Uh-huh. And oftentimes the compulsories were played live.
Okay.
So I played the compulsories, and I composed and edited. Floor music can only be a minute 30. Mm. So I had in my living room set up our cassette tape recorder with two little microphones on my dining room chairs, and I would record their floor music. And anybody that knows me knows I can't keep my mouth shut when I really want to say something and feel it's important to say it. So I would start saying, get your head up, point your feet, stop the music,
Yeah.
And out of high school, I graduated 2 years later. I remember I was still dancing with the Sacramento Ballet and wanted to go to college because I love school. My mm-hmm. parents were strong advocates of college education. But my dad's an artist, and my dad said to me, if you want to dance, then you need to do that now. you can always go back to college. Mm. And that gave me permission to follow my dream as a dancer and not feel guilty for not going to college right out of high school. And so I did that, and I danced professionally, and I was in Washington, D.C., and I was getting ready to start my first season with the Washington Ballet, and I heard that UCLA needed a dance coach for their gymnastics team. Well, I love college. I missed school. I'd been out for 4 years, and I figured the worst thing they can say is no.
Yeah.
So I found out who the head coach was, and I called him up, and I gave him my resume. And he, I'll never forget when he said, "We don't have a salary to offer you, but I can offer you a full scholarship."
Wow.
And I was like, done and done.
Wow, that's like divine intervention.
It is.
The two things you love, and you don't have to pay for it.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's pretty amazing. But, you know, one thing you just said right there is that the UCLA gymnastics team needed a dance coach. Like, to me, I would never put those two things together. That, I mean, I realize, you know, for their routines that somehow it has to get choreographed. I never imagined how that happened. Even, you know, even with figure skating, that there must be a choreographer, I guess, involved with that. So
there is a choreographer involved. And with most teams, they rely on either the student or the athletes helping to piecemeal together their routines, or the female coach on the staff maybe have been a good dancer and she can craft together a routine. I am the only gymnastics coach at my level that has the pedigree that I have in dance. And so I came to UCLA and I was their choreographer.
Amazing. I just a little bit about me. My middle daughter, who's now 23, is a professional dancer. She knew she wanted to dance since she was 2 years old. She thought she wanted to be a ballerina. And when she was 14, she announced that she hated wearing pointe shoes. And so she gravitated towards modern dance and contemporary. Now she's living and working in Philadelphia and commuting to New York for auditions and performances and stuff. So I've been taking little girls, you know, I have three daughters, and now my youngest one is almost 11, and she's been dancing since she was little, to dance class and stuff. And it never crossed my mind that gymnastics could be a natural sort of, I don't know, segue or because these kids do so much these days, and you know that they have to pick something along the way.
Right.
But it seems amazing to me that you had two somethings. Like, you had this whole life as a dancer, professional dancer. I mean, you know, being a professional ballerina for major dance companies is a career in itself. So do you ever sit back and think about, I mean, just the amazing experience of having basically two professional lives?
Yes and no, because I wasn't born to be a ballet dancer. I'm not naturally flexible. And as I was told many times in auditions, as they stand there, and you stand there and they walk up and down, they look at you, and I was told so many times, oh, your head is too big, and your neck is too short, and your feet are too small. And it's like, and what am I supposed to do with that information? So I got cast a lot of character parts. Like in Peter and the Wolf, I was the wolf.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
So when I decided to retire, had I grown up like a decade later, I probably would have been a jazz dancer. But they didn't really have, like, that whole Paula Abdul era didn't come into play until I was already at UCLA.
A little bit of trivia about Paula Abdul. I actually photographed her when she was a Laker girl. And we've stayed good friends.
That's
she
so cool.
Actually just called me a couple of weeks ago. She's going out on tour, and she's going to be bringing back, like, the Laker girl thing in some way, shape, or form during her
That's
concert
so cool.
and needed photos, you know, to show her dancing in that era. But, I'm sorry I didn't mean
and
to interrupt.
And people don't know just how much she choreographed.
Oh, yeah.
You know, for the Jacksons and all that, not just the Lakers, but they don't realize.
Yeah. For sure.
The breadth of her resume.
Yeah, incredible. All right, so fast forward, you go out to UCLA and essentially hired as a dance
choreographer.
Choreographer. How do you then become the head coach and probably one of the most successful female head coaches of all time in the sport?
I graduated with a degree in history, and I wanted to go be a journalist, but I was still choreographing the routines for the team. And 2 years or so after I graduated, the senior women's administrator, the athletic director, calls me in her office and says, we're going to make a change with our head coaching position, and we would like for you to be the new head coach. And I thought I just laughed out loud immediately. She says I was catatonic for about 30 seconds. And then I laughed and I said, you understand, I don't know the first thing about gymnastics. And she said, I've observed how you work with the student athletes, and I really like how you're tough with them, but you are compassionate.
Hmm.
And she said, I trust you'll figure the rest out.
Wow. Okay. And this is at some like junior college in Iowa. We're talking about UCLA.
And we had finished second the year before.
Oh, my goodness.
We'd lost by half of a tenth.
Wow.
So we weren't a schluppy team.
No.
We were a great team.
But what a daunting, I mean, that's, you know, a lot of people would have shied away from that. Said, look, I can't do it. I'm not ready. I don't know. You know, I'm not trained. But you just took it on.
I took it on, and I failed miserably the first few years.
Mm-hmm. So what did you learn from that?
Well,
we always talk about that here. What do we learn from our failures? Yeah.
The only thing I knew about athletics was what I'd observed, you know, in movies or on TV. And so in my mind, a coach was someone like a Pat Summitt or a Bobby Knight or a Marta Caroli.
Okay.
Just, unwavering.
Yeah, hard ass. Just
exactly.
Yeah, right.
So I thought,
do it my way or no way.
Yeah. I don't know how to do anything else, but I can act. I grew up on stage. I can act like a coach. So I did.
I love it.
And I learned to say all their little quips, you know, that are really mean-spirited. And we did horribly. And so I thought, well, I just need to act better.
Yeah.
So I was more mean and more stern the next year. And we did even worse. We didn't even make it to the national championships.
Oh, boy.
And true story, I was on my way to resign. And I honestly didn't feel like I had failed. I don't believe in the term failure anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt like, duh, I told you I wasn't the right person for this job.
Right.
And I was walking through the student store, and I happened upon one of Coach Wooden's books on leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened to open to his definition of success.
Oh, come on. That's just amazing.
It is. I know. When they write the movie, this is like the aha moment.
Yeah, right.
And spotlight. The angels sing and the heavens part.
Right.
And I read his definition of success, which if you're a sports person, you know, doesn't mention winning.
Right.
Success is peace of mind and knowing you've done your best.
Mm.
And I kept reading it over and over because here was one of the greatest, if not the greatest coach that ever lived. He'd won 10 national championships. I am a coach in athletics. You're hired to win.
Mm-hmm.
That is your definition of success.
Especially at a major university.
At a major university.
Division I, yeah.
That had won a lot of championships.
Right.
And I kept reading it. And it says, success is peace of mind and knowing you have done your best. And at that moment, I had the biggest aha moment of my life. Success is peace of mind and knowing you have done your best. I had been trying to be somebody else.
Hmm.
And at that moment, I realized when you try to be somebody else, you will always be a second-rate them. I would never be as good at Pat Summitt being Pat Summitt as she's being Pat Summitt.
Hmm.
And the worst thing about it is it prevents you from being a first-rate you.
Mm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I didn't resign, and I went back to, I was going to say my office, but we didn't have offices. We had cubicles. And I thought, okay, I was hired for a reason. They saw something in me. What do I bring to the table coaching gymnasts? I'd had 17 years of classical ballet training. I knew what it was like to work through pain, point shoes, mini torture chambers, right?
Yeah.
I knew what it was like to be a young woman and have to get into a leotard every day.
Mm.
I knew about body shaming.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what it was like to have to go through puberty. Mm. And that I knew, most importantly, I knew how to prepare physically, mentally, and emotionally. So when I was standing in the wings, I was calm, excited, and confident.
Mm.
Even though there were buckets there for some of the principal dancers or soloists that got so nervous, they would throw up.
Oy, okay. Yeah.
And when I looked at our athletes, gymnasts waiting in the wings is when they're standing there waiting for the judge to salute them before they go up on an event.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I could prepare them to be confident with their performances as well, if not better, than any other gymnastics coach in the country.
Mm-hmm.
I just had to hire really good people to actually teach the gymnastics part.
Right.
But I could do the rest of it as well, if not better, than anybody else. And once I started just like etch and sketched everything that I knew and started implementing everything that I had learned in the ballet studio and on stage, that's when we started having success, as in winning. Part of it is I'm at UCLA. I get to recruit some of the best talent in the world.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Coach wouldn't always just say you can't win without talent.
Right.
So it wasn't just that my methods were so brilliant.
Yeah.
But, and I'll never, ever, ever forget one of my seniors said a few years later, she said, "Miss Val, you finally became a leader worth following." Because you were true to yourself and not trying to be somebody else.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, it's very similar to somebody asked Kobe very early in his career about being the next Michael Jordan. He goes, "I don't have no interest in being the next Michael Jordan. I want to be the first Kobe."
That's great.
You know?
And after we won, I think it was 2004, we'd won four championships in 5 years. LA Times did a piece on me and Coach Wooden.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, they listed all these accolades and of mine, and they said, "You're becoming the next John Wooden."
Mm.
And before I could respond, Coach, you know, with his eyes, arms crossed and his blue eyes twinkling, said, "Why would she want to be another John Wooden when she can be a great Valerie Condosfield?"
Well, good for him.
Mic drop. I didn't even answer the question.
Well, what a blessing that you could be around him and that, what an epiphany of this book thing. I mean, what a story that is. You're literally going to resign.
I was going to
on
resign. On my way to resign.
Unbelievable
and
story.
And I'm not proud to say, like when I say I studied other coaches, he wasn't one of them I studied. I'd never met him. We trained in the John Wooden gym. And I think, like, people ask me, why wasn't he the first one for you to study as a mentor? And I think it's because he really wasn't that charismatic. You know, he wasn't a big personality.
Right.
Like a Bobby Knight.
Well, he talked about his, you know, your reputation. You shouldn't be judged by what you, how many trophies you win, your character. It should be your reputation. And I'm paraphrasing, of course. But he, you know, Bill Walton, of course, adored Coach Wooden. He, in every interview, he manages to get a Coach Wooden anecdote or quoted there. One of my favorite guys. Just being on the UCLA campus must be pretty cool as part of the athletics department, right?
It is. And I've been there for 36 years, and I can honestly say when I get out of the parking lot and I walk on Bruin Walk, I am so honored that I have been able to be the steward of this gymnastics program. And, okay, so times 100 when you walk into Pauley.
But
the lore, the history, the everything. Just, it is a magical, magical place.
Sure, and their football program. I actually, early in my career, when Troy Aikman was at UCLA, and there's a whole story I'll tell you about that later, about Troy. But I got to shoot their football program, I think for like 5 years in a row, for their recruiting brochure, which was just like a little brochure in those days, and they made it into this gigantic kind of annual report thing. But it was thrilling just to be around, because I went to the University of Massachusetts, which, you know, I think we won like one game in 3 years. I mean, it was terrible. Our marching band had like six people in it. It was really, it was sad.
I'm sorry. And but you turned out well.
Yeah, I did. But, you know, we drank heavily there. It was fun. We had a lot of fun at the games in the freezing cold. So, you know.
You have to in that weather.
But I wasn't, I had never been, even though it was a giant school, I hadn't been subjected to big time college Division One stuff, you know, and to go into, I think UCLA was playing in the Coliseum back then.
Right.
And, you know, there's 70, 80,000 people at a football game, and then you go to Pauley Pavilion, and I covered gymnastics.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you were there when I covered, because I was trying to just shoot as much as I could.
This was Detroit, this late 80s?
Beginning of the 80s, and women's basketball and all that stuff. It was just, I regretted the fact that I had gotten accepted to UCLA, and I didn't have the guts to come out here to California. Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know. I needed to be close to home. I don't know what it was. Maybe it's the time zones or something. I don't know. But I decided to stay back east.
The weather. You just did not want to be in 75-degree weather.
Yeah, well, that changed the minute I got here, and then that was the end of that. So, Coach, Miss Val, sorry. People call you Coach?
You know what? They do call me Coach, okay. And I don't want the misconception that I ask people to call me Miss Val.
No, I love
it's,
that.
It's, yeah. As we all know, you know, when you grow up in the ballet studio, yeah. You call your teachers Miss.
Sure.
So,
yeah. I'm used to it.
Early on, the first week I was at UCLA in 1982, they asked me, or the head coach asked me to teach our team give them a ballet class.
Uh-huh.
And one of the little smart aleck gymnasts says, are we supposed to call you Miss Val? And I said, great, call me Miss Val. And that's how it all happened.
Well, I'm used to it from my daughters, believe me.
Yeah.
And we see, you know, we're in Trader Joe's, and I'll see one of my kids, you know, early dance teachers, oh, Miss Emily, you know.
Right.
Like, you call me Emily now.
But it's so funny, because when people call me Coach, even though I've been coaching for so long, I kind of giggle inside. Like, oh my gosh, they're calling me Coach. I'm not a coach.
Hey everyone, it's Andy Bernstein. You may know me from my Hall of Fame career as a sports photographer. Well, just like you, we all want to take great photos of our sports, travel, or family. To take great photos, you need great camera equipment and a great store. Paul's Photo has what you need, and they have what I need. The team at Paul's Photo can help you choose the right camera and teach you how to use it. Paul's Photo. Call them at 310-375-7014 or find them 24/7 online at paulsphoto.com. Paul's Photo, your local camera store, no matter where you live.
Well, you brought up an interesting thing about the whole body shaming, body issue between, ballet especially, not as much in other areas of dance, but especially ballet. Mm-hmm. And my little daughter her best friend actually is on the track. You know, she's almost 11. She has that perfect body for ballet now at 11, and she is trying to kind of move up to those next levels. And, of course, the parents are very conscious of what's going to happen when puberty hits and all that. And it is always, honestly, as a parent, always broke my heart to go to ballet recitals. And there are girls who didn't look the same. They were a little heavier. And they're trying, you know, but yet they're not going to be professional dancers. Even in my daughter's college, which was an arts college where they were being trained to be professional dancers, is that ever going to end? I mean, is there ever going to be a time when you're going to see ballet dancers that all don't look exactly the same, or gymnasts that might be a little bit different looking? Although we have seen that. But
I hope that we're on the cusp of changing. I've been asked a lot about how do we change the culture of our sport. And in fact, I was in Washington, D.C. this summer. I met with Dianne Feinstein and Senator Feinstein and some people from the House of Representatives. And they're all asking the same thing because of all the horrific things that went on with gymnastics this last year. And it was so blatantly clear to me when I was asked that question, how are we going to change the culture? And it's not just in gymnastics. And it's not just in athletics. It's in all sports. It's in schools. It's parenting. It's parents. We need to start redefining success for our children because the reports of depression and loneliness and suicide attempts and all of that in our youth is skyrocketed more so than any other time in our history.
This generation, yeah, absolutely.
And it comes from the stress that, it starts in the home.
Yeah.
It starts with that SAT. It starts with having to get A's. It starts, you know, and so that's why, you know, I keep coming back to Coach Wooden's definition of success. It really is about being at the end of the day, being in the, have a little debrief with yourself and just saying, did I do my best today? Did I, as an athlete, did I eat well? Am I getting enough sleep? Did I hydrate? Did I drink too much alcohol? As a student, did I actually pay attention in class? And if you can check off all those boxes and say yes, then you deserve to feel successful. You don't have to be at the top of the podium. You don't have to get an A. You don't have to get perfect SATs to feel successful in life. And that's one reason why the best example of that we have today is Caitlin Ohashi, our young athlete, our senior that went viral.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been on every talk show mm-hmm. the last week. And, you know, sadly, as she's gotten over 50, 60 million views now, there are people that are just so mean-spirited commenting about her body and her thighs. And she's not the typical-looking gymnast.
Well, yeah.
At all.
Right.
But she is at the top of her game. She is bringing joy to the world with her integrity that she's given this sport.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, like, whenever I go to speak in gyms and all that, I say, I will show up and I'll speak, but I want to be able to talk to the parents.
Mm.
We have got to change how we parent. We've got to change how we coach.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to change our definition of success. And I feel that the United States Gymnastics needs to show the rest of the world how you can train champions in a joyful, healthy manner.
Mm.
And it's our job to show the world how to do that because we're the ones that are under this microscope right now.
Right. So it seems like things are changing with this young athlete because she's achieving incredible marks and scores
mm-hmm.
and doesn't look like the cookie cutter gymnast mm-hmm. that at least, you know, myself and a lot of people probably think should look like.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I, as you're speaking, I'm thinking like of Serena Williams, you know, probably arguably the greatest women's tennis player of all time, not just his generation.
Right.
And she doesn't look like a tennis player.
No. Right.
But why does she have to look like anything?
Right.
She's a great tennis player.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. So tell us what excites you about coaching. I mean, is it the competition? I mean, probably a whole bunch of stuff. But what really do you enjoy just being around the athletes? Do you enjoy, you know, give us kind of an overview of your life, what keeps you kind of motivated every day?
Early on as a head coach, I had to figure out my why. Why was I going to do this?
Mm-hmm.
Because one day it hit me as I was walking into the athletic department that there was, I think the budget at that time was $50 million or something, is being spent on bragging rights. And then I thought about Pee Wee football and the Olympics and NFL and blah, all athletics was about being able to say, ha ha, we beat you.
Mm.
And I thought, ew. There has to be more to this than bragging rights.
Mm.
And then I realized that the athletes and the coaches actually are the ones that learn really, really, really tough lessons through their sports.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason why we young people, that's why I think we need to put PE back in the schools
mm-hmm.
because there are things that you don't learn in the classroom.
Yeah.
You don't learn about perseverance. You don't learn about team being a team player. You don't learn about sacrificing yourself for the goodness of the team.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Taya said, and he came up to me one time in our gym, and he said, Miss Val, you have the toughest sport. And I said, why? And he goes, there's nobody to pass the ball to.
Right.
What a great life lesson.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You're out there on your own pretty
right.
much. Right.
I mean, you get nervous up on
team.
That beam. You can't jump off the beam and pass the ball and
right.
say, go finish my routine, please.
Yeah.
And so when I realized that and I figured out my why, and I was so – that's mm-hmm. one reason why I've stayed at UCLA so long is that athletics is not a religion
mm-hmm.
at UCLA. And we really honor the process of using sport to develop these champions in life
mm-hmm.
that then translates to the competition floor. So you asked me what I love. I don't really love the competitions.
Mm.
I don't even look at them as competitions. I look at them as performances.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do mm-hmm. all the hard work during the week, and then let's go perform and
right.
celebrate our hard work.
Uh-huh.
But I love being able to train young women to become superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And I love to train them in all aspects of their life to then, when they leave us and graduate, to go out in the world mm-hmm. and really make a positive difference.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So they don't have to leave you and be this world-class Olympic, you know, gymnast. They could go and do something else in a career. But the fact that what you left them with, what you mentored them in life, has to be so satisfying
it
to
is.
You. Yeah.
And last
that's
year,
a wonderful,
when
that's
we were,
a wonderful thing.
When we were going through our season, I chose to talk about the sexual abuse scandal that was happening. Because
mm-hmm.
our volunteer coach, Jordan Weber, had just gotten through giving her impact statement in Michigan flew to us. We were competing at Arizona. And I was like, we're not just going to brush this on the rug and pretend like it's not happening.
Right.
And I knew at that point that we had some victims on our team. I didn't know who they were. I hadn't talked to them yet. But I figured out who they probably were. And I chose to talk about it. And after we won the championship, Kyla Ross, Olympic gold medalist in 2012, said in an interview, she said, I really feel the fact that Miss Val talked to us about this. She says, I know for myself, because she came out as a victim, and she said, she helped me put words to my feelings of how I was feeling and helped me to process this. And she says, Miss Val, I actually felt myself walk taller as the season went on. And she said, had we not addressed it, we would not have won that championship.
Well, my goodness. Wow.
So, I mean, how rewarding for that, right?
Amazing. Yeah, I was at the ESPYs last year, and I didn't know what was going to happen at the end. And here I am trying to shoot this. And more and more and more women are coming on stage. And the first thing that comes to my mind is, do I have a wide enough lens to get the whole stage? And they just kept coming. And I just, I texted my wife. I said, you're not going to believe this when we watch it later. Because it was, you know, it was going to home. I taped it. And my wife is Title IX coordinator. She's the director of equity and diversity at Cal State LA. Now she's over at USC. So this is part of our, like, daily conversation. And wow, what a that's an impactful story.
It is.
You know, something else that isn't talked about that much is people overcoming all kinds of things in life, and we like to shed light on that in Legends of Sport. Athletes who have had you know, problems with money or problems with drugs, or have been able to seek the help and get the help, and sometimes we sort of are the catalyst for that. And your battle with breast cancer is something that I guess changed you as a person. My mom unfortunately died from breast cancer, and it's and it was you know, it was one of those life lessons that, you know, as a parent.
How old were you?
I was, this was in 2004, so, you know, it was only 14 years ago, almost 15 now. So I was, you know, I was old. I was 45. Did your perspective, and I don't want to get too philosophical or anything, but your, just your perspective of life and how you approach your job, did that change?
Yep. And I have to get philosophical because it is going through breast cancer changed every part of my life for the better. And I don't, you know, for you and your listeners, I don't know how you will translate this. But when I hung up from my doctor and she said, you have a very aggressive form of breast cancer, you need to get in here immediately. And at that moment, I heard very, very clearly, be anxious for nothing and grateful for all things. And whether you translate that as the universe speaking to me or cosmic energy, I translated that as God speaking and saying, and I heard it twice, be anxious for nothing and grateful for all things. And I went home to my husband and I told him the not so great news about the breast cancer. And I said, but get this. I heard be anxious for nothing and grateful for all things. And he said, it's from the Bible. Well, I grew up Greek Orthodox.
I was going to ask you, did this come from some
No, I never read the Bible in English. Well, I never read it in Greek. But I grew up with it. I mean, Greek. I mean, Greek Orthodox. The services are in Greek. And he says, go look it up. And I was like, okay. And so I went and looked it up. And sure enough, in Philippians 4, it says, be anxious for nothing. And then paraphrased, grateful for all things. And it's like my whole world stopped. And I went, I heard this before I ever read this.
Oh, boy. Where did that come from?
God. So then I said,
the same God that had opened that page of John Wooden's book?
And so, he's been around a while. And so I remember thinking, this is a commandment. This is not a suggestion. And I absolutely chose to obey, but I didn't know how I was going to obey because I just got diagnosed with a potentially fatal disease. So
how old were you at the time?
54.
Yeah. Okay.
55.
Yeah.
So I went to my oncologist the next day, and she shows up with this big smile on her face, which I thought was odd. And she says, had you gotten diagnosed 10 years ago, we had nothing for you. You've gone from having the worst type of breast cancer to the best type. Because if you choose, one of my favorite words, if you choose to get chemotherapy for a year, I know it's going to work.
Okay.
And at that moment, I understood the commandment, how I was not going to be anxious through gratitude by being grateful from the fact that I didn't have to get chemo. I get to get chemo.
Wow. Not too many people would have looked at it that way, Coach Val.
And that has changed every moment of my life since then. I don't have to do whatever I don't like to. I hate putting gas in my car. I don't have to. Guess what? I get to put gas in my car because I can afford a car, and I can afford the gas to put in the car. How cool is that?
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, you know, we've done almost 40 podcasts, and that's one of the most inspirational things I've heard somebody say in this space. So thank you for that. That's I got to process that a little bit.
And you know what? Okay. So as a coach, right?
Yes.
You're on the competition floor. You're hired to win, right?
Yeah.
And it's all out of your control right now. What they do on that balance beam, I have no control.
Yeah.
And so you get anxious. And so ever since that moment, I've tried to prove God wrong. That there are moments in life where being anxious helps. No, they're not.
No.
And I've even talked to people in the military. I've talked to surgeons.
Yeah.
I've challenged people. Is there anything, any moment in your life where being anxious has helped the situation? Nope.
Wow. Yeah, it just kind of gets in the way.
It does.
And it holds you back.
And it makes you clouded.
Right.
And it makes you tense. And it makes you unable to process clearly. Yep.
Yeah. It must be incredibly inspiring for your young athletes to have been part of your recovery and your story, and a living testament of beating a deadly disease.
It was great.
Yeah.
It was great to go through that year with them.
Yeah.
In fact, one of my favorite stories and memories of that time is when I told them in a team meeting, they start looking at my breasts, right?
Yeah.
So I get this wild idea that it was the tumor was on the outside of my right breast, and I was like, these are young women, and this tumor does not feel like anything like we're told. Like, we're told to feel for a hard, round, pea-sized shape. This felt like it was a long-pulled muscle. I have an opportunity to have my athletes feel what a malignant tumor feels like. So I invited them to feel the tumor. So one of them comes up, I think it was Sam Peschek, and she says, whoa, this is weird. I'm feeling Miss Val's breast. I said, no, I didn't invite you to feel my breast. I invited you to feel what a malignant tumor feels like. And at that moment, sirens are going off in my head, like HR is going to come down here and fire my ass on the spot.
Yeah, I could see my wife getting a little excited about that.
And at that moment, you know what? I felt this was too important of a teaching moment. I was willing to put my job on the line for that.
Wow. I assume HR didn't come down.
They didn't. And they don't really like it when I tell that story, but it is a true story.
That's a great story. It's a beautiful story. And if I had a daughter in that same situation, scenario, I would be grateful to a person like you who would treat the disease with dignity. And the fact that, look, this is an opportunity now. All the optimism that you're...
Yeah.
It's amazing. Well, Ms. Val, what's next for you? I mean, are you going to... Is there like a end to the story of coaching? Are you going to go off in the sunset and, you know, go fishing somewhere or something? I mean, what do you love to do when you're not working, first of all?
Lots of things.
Okay, so traveling?
No. I probably work way too much, but I don't feel like I work at all.
Yeah.
For the last 28 years, I've been choreographing the live shows at SeaWorld San Diego.
I read that, yes.
They're Cirque du Soleil type of shows.
Yeah.
So I've
seen
loved
them.
Doing that. Have you?
I didn't realize you were the one.
Yeah.
They're beautiful. Yeah.
We've won 2 international awards.
Oh, that's so great. Yes.
Yeah. But when I was diagnosed, you know, you realize You know, it hit me. We all have an expiration date.
Yeah.
I just don't know when mine is,
right.
And there's a lot I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So at that moment, I realized that I was going to retire, and I gave it 3 more years. So this is my last season.
This is your last season?
Yes.
Wow. So this could be like one of your last major, I don't say major, but one of your last interviews?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's really...
As a sitting head coach.
That's amazing. Wow.
And people think I'm crazy because we're, you know, I'm riding the crest.
Yes.
We just came off of a championship. Mm-hmm. Our team is even better this year than we were last year.
Right.
But when I was sitting in my chemo spa for that year, I started checking off my bucket list. And so one of them was to write a book. So I wrote Life is Short, Don't Wait to Dance, which is a bestseller. Yay.
God bless you.
I know. Thank you.
Yes.
It's doing very, very well.
Oh, that's so great.
And I am hell-bent on producing an urban nutcracker.
Oh, an urban nutcracker.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you have a dance company in mind?
No, I want it to be a mixture of like X Games and street performance arts like parkour and all that with the classics of Tchaikovsky. In fact, NBC had gotten it for a two-hour movie of the week, but they shelved it because DreamWorks was coming out with their Nutcracker and their Four Realms.
Mm-hmm.
But it's nothing like my vision. So that's going to get done.
Mm.
I am also bound and determined to get a course on John Wooden at UCLA.
Uh-huh.
And I got Coach's blessing to do that before he passed.
Wow. Okay.
And I'm doing a lot of speaking.
Yeah.
And so there's my plate is very full.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm retiring because I want to do all these things while I still have the energy and inspiration to do them. Because I'm going to be 60 in August.
Oh, you'll be joining the club I'm already in.
Yay! I can't wait.
Yeah.
I honestly can't. When I turned 40, one of my student athletes said, Miss Val, women just start getting sexy when they're 40.
Mm-hmm.
And she mentioned all the women my age, like Michelle Pfeiffer and Madonna and all these people, Renee Rousseau.
Yeah.
And she said, and men don't even start getting sexy till they're 50. So I have lived by that
awesome.
The last few decades.
Yeah, well, I threw myself a gigantic disco party.
Oh, my gosh.
I went, seriously.
That must have been so much fun.
At some point,
fun.
I'll email you the video. We bought out the conga room at LA Live and... Everyone came in costume. It was fantastic.
I need to do that.
It was fun for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Miss Val, I got to tell you what an honor it's been and a pleasure.
Thank
and
you.
It's also been different for our listeners because you know most of the names that come on are either household names or people that follow their careers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your career is a little bit like kind of in the background, but your story is so inspirational.
And
you as a person, it's thrilling to have you. So thank you so much.
Thanks for
being part of it.
I really appreciated this. This
thank
was fun.
You. Okay. I mean, I might be like partial, but... how did you guys feel about that interview? Because I truly believe it was one of the best podcasts we've had. you know, Valerie has done so much in her life. She's accomplished so much. But I really think her mission now to help all of us understand that quote unquote, life is short, don't wait to dance, which happens to be the title of her best-selling book, which you all should get. The book will be a contest item for us this week, a signed book by Valerie. So, again, tag 3 friends and enter the contest, and some lucky person will get this book because it's a really, really great read for a really iconic person. I'm so happy to have met her and understand what it took for her to get to the level that she accomplished as a gymnastics coach, but also in life. And great, great message. So thank you, Valerie. Thank you for being part of our podcast. Thank you for being part of our Legends of Sport family. You are a true icon and legend. And as you kind of go off into the sunset after 27 years as the head gymnastics coach at UCLA, multi champion, with so much success behind you, I can only see that life has even more to offer to you. So thanks again, Valerie. And I know our paths will cross again soon.
Remember, folks, you can find us on the iHeart app and online, as well as Apple and Spotify and your favorite podcast platform. Keep following us on Instagram at Legends of Sport, our Twitter at Legends_of Sport, our website, legendsofsport.net, and our YouTube and TikTok channels, Legends of Sport. My photography can be found on Instagram and Twitter at ADB Photo Inc. And another reminder, please check out the website for Beyond the Lens at www.beyondthelens.live. Thanks, everyone, for continuing to support the Legends of Sport podcast. Remember to rate and review and tell all your friends. We'll be back next week with another great guest and episode. Until then, stay safe, stay well.